All right, Horace Asimkar, a curiosity, and I know there's a big subject you want to talk about, but I want to talk about something tangential to that. When large existing organizations like car companies think about something new, and you think about what Apple does, right, with the watch, and they have enough brand equity that some percentage of their customers will probably buy whatever they produce, assuming it continues to be a good product. But in the case of automotive change, if you look at BMW and Ford, for example, they have launched any number of sub-brands, startups, initiatives, even venture funds. BMW has iVentures. Ford has Techstars. There's a variety of things. So Ford has GoPark, GoDrive, Techstars, Dynamic Shuttle Service, Ford Credit Link. BMW has ReachNow, DriveNow, ParkNow, among other things. Mm-hmm. So what does that tell you about their approach to something new? Does that tell you that they are, you know, taking a shotgun? Are they taking a rifle? Are they saying, let's see what sticks? I mean, what does that tell you about that, Horace?
Well, you know, we have a theory about this. If something that's new is potentially sustaining to the core, car companies will be all over it. They're just going to be very eager to try something new. A lot of these initiatives may appear to be tangential, that it's not exactly car manufacturing, but companies are not allergic to innovations. They're just allergic to innovations that cause them to feel like they're in decline, or they are allergic to innovations that cause them to lose money forever. That's the fundamental, I think, test of whether innovation is going to be absorbed or not. Once you say that, it becomes really difficult to take any one thing and ask and or answer definitively about it and say this is definitely a sustaining or disruptive thing. Often their nature emerges over time, as in fact technologies are often seeking a business model, and that business model does not reveal itself for some time. And so as they play along with it, if the business model begins to look in opposition to what they're seeking, then they'll just quietly shelve it and put it aside. Let me take an example from something closer to tech, which was robotics. As we remember, Boston Robotics was acquired by Google. Now, everybody expected them to run away with it. Run with it. And so it was a darling of Andy Rubin's, and he was always a fan of robotics. And this was a company that was living mostly off of government research grants. So they were building robots that could conceivably be used in defense applications. But the problem is that after a few years, the business model did not come together for that technology, at least not the way Google wanted to go. And Google, of all people, is the most supposedly open-minded as far as innovations
spending
are
money,
concerned.
Right?
I mean, you can't say, well, I don't see how a facsimile of a robotic dog helps Google search. But everybody attributes to Google this ability to sort of be completely uninterested in synergies, uninterested in business models that are
profit
that are profit driven. Exactly. So they were, you know, everything's a moonshot. Well, the fact is that there are limits, and the question is that in the case of Google, this turned out to be completely on the line. That maybe there were other issues like the politics and the people. Same thing with Nest, but people always point their fingers to the politics and the people as saying they're the causes of failure of whatever. The fact is that if things were hunky dory, if things were wonderful and aligned and growing, you bury the politics and the people. You sort of
it doesn't
work
matter,
through them.
Right?
Yeah, you work exactly. through that
right.
stuff.
Right.
If things don't work, those surface, and because they surface, people point the finger to them and say, "Aha! This is why it didn't work." So it's not so simple. So in that sense, when you see a venture fail, and this is an internal venture, this could be a venture that an initiative, a grand idea, and the failure occurs, people always point to the people and the politics and say they killed it, or it was politics killed it, you know, if you want to be polite. And that's happening now, the finger pointing around Nest. But the fundamental problem is that actually these were dumb ideas. It's a dumb idea to, you know, buy a robotics company if you're a search company. It's a dumb idea to buy a Nest product line, which is actually going to be sold through Apple stores and nowhere else, as a business, as a foundation for something else that's going to grow into, you know. It's like someone pointed this out to me, said, why do a triple bank shot when you're playing pool, when you could just hit the ball, right? Why bounce it off of three walls so that you can get it this really clever shot?
Short of the elegance, right? Yeah. So in this case, in talking about cars, the message from watching all of this rhetoric and this brand exercise or brand diffusion, let's call it, is that the companies perhaps are wondering if their brand can extend into the new era. And that's really the gist of my question. You know, do they have the moxie to do it?
Yeah, brands are funny because, you know, like this is another one of these very poorly defined terms. To me, the brand is a meaning. It's a word with meaning. It's a word that means X. You know, and I always say, you know, usually the meaning is one of trust. So you can trust this because it's got my brand on it.
Exactly.
And since I've proven and I've demonstrated and I've gained and earned your trust, I don't need to do it over and over again. And by putting this brand on it, I've embodied inside this name all the accumulated trust, all of it. It's all in that little word.
Buy with confidence. Yes.
Exactly. And even made in USA or made in China have brand value. Why would you stamp it on everything? It's because it says, trust it. It's mm-hmm. made from a place that knows how to make things, supposedly.
Right.
So the thing is that if you ask, well, at some point, if the definition of what is good and the definition of what you should trust changes, it doesn't really help you to have that brand. And this is why companies create new brands. A brand may just have meaning that is no longer appropriate to a market that it needs to enter. So if you're – the interesting case study for Toyota for Nissan, it used to be called Datsun. Why Datsun? Probably they chose Datsun because it sounded –
You know, we always show our age on the show, Horace. What's Datsun? Who knows that?
I've heard they're actually bringing it back.
I heard that too.
But Datsun, why would they even pick that? It's probably, and by the way, Toyota was Toyoda with a D.
Right.
And then they changed it to Toyota, probably again because it sounded better in the Western language, or maybe it was more alliterative because it had the two T's. And so who knows why, but they picked the name. And then over time, the name got injected with meaning. But I think that they rebrand because somehow either the meaning is no longer relevant or the meaning has become negative or for any number of reasons. Coca-Cola became Coke for, you know, sort of sustaining reasons.
Syllables matter, though.
As well, as everything matters. Yeah. You know, when you talk about this stuff, people get bogged down in all kinds of semantics and psychology. But the point of a car company is like classic. This is what they call badge engineering. I think in the UK they call it, you know, engineering the badge, right? So they used to put names together to appropriate sub-names.
Sure. General Motors built the empire with that, yeah.
Exactly. So this
Pontiac,
is something that's
Chevy,
not...
Chevy, Oldsmobile, the whole Buick, Cadillac, yeah, the whole thing.
It's not new. So this brings me to this question. It's like BMW had to introduce the I designation for this new line
of
cars.
The new thing.
And it's a completely different style, look, Visual language they use. We use this word that designers use to describe what the thing looks like in general. Because why? Because when they went to I, they sort of decided that they couldn't transition their existing brand. This is my belief. The existing BMW brand, which means what? Excellence in driving.
One hopes, yes.
Well, it used to mean. BMW was, what were their taglines?
Ultimate driving machine, Horace.
Exactly.
There you Again, go. We're showing our age, yes. Not an SUV.
The ultimate driving machine, and going electric is not about that anymore. So you can't say that with a straight face, although I think some try. But Tesla tries, and it certainly is a fast machine, but it's not necessarily a fast, the handling isn't there. And if you do often speed, you see, here's a fundamental issue, and I'll talk about the i3 in a minute because I'm driving one nowadays. What's at odds here is that an environmental label or meaning has to be contradictory to a speed meaning, because speed consumes a huge amount of energy. Acceleration, which Tesla talks about a lot in terms of their
performance.
They keep really harping on performance. Mm-hmm. In fact, even range itself, which they declare as one of their performance metrics, is itself an environmentally destructive thing. And let me tell you why. Because acceleration requires energy. This is F equals ma. You want to do a big A. You're going to need a lot of force, and so the thing is that when you do floor it, and you get sensitive to this if you're driving an electric car, you see your range really drop. Of course you'd know that in a gas car, but it's even more apparent, I think, in an electric car. Aggressive driving in an electric car really kills your range, and very gentle driving really extends your range. So in fact, the i3
the feedback
has
loop
modes.
Is right. The feedback loop is there.
Yeah, it's
way.
Very clear, and in fact, you can see it numerically because usually you get a range in numbers. So if you see your range suddenly drop, it's a jarring moment. but the point, and one other thing is that when you want range, you want a lot of batteries, and that means a lot of weight, and that means again more carrying around that weight all the time. So there's nothing environmentally nice about a 5,000-pound car. There's nothing environmentally nice about a highly accelerating car. So if BMW were to have done what Tesla did and said, we're going to make our best performing cars be electric, they would have had to say that electric power is marketed as a virtue of the existing brand. But what they chose with the I brand, which maybe it's a mistake, but what they chose with the I brand is an environmental brand. The idea is that you can no longer say this is about driving, about power, it's something else. Now, you could say, well, it's about appealing to people's conscious need to be environmentally...
aware, branded, whatever.
Aware. But when you see the car in terms of its design, and there's a lot of things here in the details that in terms of material choices, compromises made in engineering. Engineering is nothing more than compromise and knowing what the trade-off is.
Oh, and they did make some, no doubt about it.
Quite a few. So the point is that they went into almost an extreme. You have skinny tires. Skinny tires means poor performance around turns. You have odd design overall. Part of that comes from the materials choices. Part of that comes from the manufacturing choices. Did you know, for example, that they chose a production site for carbon, which is actually in the United States because it's located near a source of...
Right, the power, the
thermal, hydroelectric power.
Hydroelectric power, state of Washington, yeah.
And that the computation that was used in crash testing was sourced on servers located in Iceland, which had...
Natural resources.
Thermal sources or wind sources.
Right.
And so they thought about it and they said, here's a clean sheet of paper, hair engineer.
For the infrastructure, yes.
Work out how to make a car, how to build a car, how to design a car, how to test a car, how to manufacture, how to implement, how to... Everything in the most environmentally protected way. And so that case, they went, you know, perhaps overboard, but it's essentially that's what they wanted to infuse the brand with, because they wanted to communicate at that point as a business. You say this I brand is really about environment, and this I brand is really about taking. Now, of course, there was a lead time of years and years. So when they would started on this project, probably 5 years ago or more, that was a time when that was the consciousness. Now it may have changed, and it may change yet again, and that's the trouble with the car industry, is that things change faster than you do. But you could see how that embodied in the brand is this kind of really logic of what you know, when you try to engineer the brand, you try to predict, plan, and execute on a vision of what it should be, as opposed to the old brands, which were like, well, just do what we do, and people will come to believe, they came to believe what they believed. You just do good work, mm-hmm. and they somehow assume that that means it's a good product. And
right. The example we talked about a while ago was Honda's first hybrid, which looked like a Civic, I believe, or was a Civic. And then the Prius, which looked very different and right. had a different brand. And yeah, exactly, exactly. It's an interesting Toyota, psychology.
You know,
yeah. Yeah.
This brand, you know, creating Lexus, creating Scion, creating, right. you know, or buying Mini, buying Jaguar, if you're Tata, buying
yeah, Range Rover,
Rolls yeah. Royce or yeah. Range Rover. Buying Bentley, and you're taking a mid, you know, performance brand like BMW, and then you're tacking on a high end, you're tacking on a low end. You're always searching for growth, and you always want to spread out your bets. And you can't stretch your brand across all of these. And so you buy or you build, and you buy brands, and then you build brands, because there was no environmental brand. BMW chose to build an environmental brand, and that's what the I is. It even goes down to having the different color. You know, it has a blue ring around the BMW logo. So a lot of apparently coloring the brand, the coloring the existing logo is the way to go these days as far as changing it.
Right. Yeah. The identity, the theme, the experience, right.
It's interesting because one thing they didn't do is they didn't, like they did with Mini, there's no BMW badge on a Mini. But when it comes to the eye, they sort of said, well, we still need the BMW badge and we still need the kidney grill somewhere, even though there is no radiator behind it.
but that whole – so obviously they made the choice. They thought, you know, we need a significant extension of our brand with iSeries. And I remember when I drove it the first time 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago now, and I went and somehow got an invitation to one of our local dealers, and it was not the dealer folks who I'd met before. It was a road show. You know, they had hired a third-party road show to go and essentially go all over the country and let people drive these things. I think they had eight of them, and on and on and on. And so that sort of told me another thing, you know, that maybe they have issues with the channel, right, in getting the message across. And I wonder how that's played out. Well, because if you look at the sales data, for example, mm-hmm. while it has sold, 24,000, 25,000, a chunk of those are into cars or transport as a service or car as a service fleets, which they happen to own a chunk of those too. Yeah,
we don't know how many.
I know in Denmark, if you look, there is data out there. In Denmark, I think last year there were 407 sales, and I think 400 or close to that were into the fleet. And you know, that's a common thing. But yeah, yes, obviously there are some sales.
I got things. Some data from Twitter on people who asked the same question. I was talking about the i3, and they said, well, I wonder how many go into these fleets. And somebody answered, well, we have 500 here and 500 there or something like that.
Right.
I would imagine it's not, it's still only about 20%, which might be like an order of magnitude more than other car companies do this with. And so, yeah, it's probably much higher than average, but it isn't. I wouldn't say it's a majority yet. But yes, it's an odd car, and it's a very strange decision, I think, in terms of design. But having driven it, I got to really appreciate it. And
it drives for what it is. It drives better than I expected. I agree. I like the single pedal very much. Actually, after I drove it for a while,
you could probably get rid of the brake
right.
pedal.
exactly.
You know, or do something else with it. They shrank it. They made it smaller as a sort of an indication of their lack of commitment to the brake.
Well, that was my big criticism of the car was I think they went all out in many ways. But the interior aspects of it, they certainly did. But the controls, the driver interface, I thought were a complete compromise because they brought forward all the things they had in their other models, and I thought that was a mistake. But
what do you mean? I don't follow.
Well, in 2000, when the first 7 Series came out with iDrive, you know, the Microsoft PC built in, they got rid of a lot of knobs. Uh-huh. And then they got all kinds of blowback. So then the knobs came back, but they still kept the touchscreen, not the the knob and all of that. So now, if you get iDrive, you generally get knobs plus this other thing. So it's hugely complicated.
The i3
had all that stuff, and it had both. And in fact, it had it from their other cars. And
okay,
I thought,
so
I understand why that happens, but from a user experience, I think that was a mistake, and I bet it'll be gone in the next one if they stick with it.
Yeah. So let me give my points on that.
Yes.
I agree with you generally. My expectations are so low for in car
cars
controls,
and you're an optimist too.
Yeah, no, but I just it has two displays. It doesn't have. I mean, it has a tiny LED
right.
display front, augmented by what we call idiot lights, which are little lights that come on. So when you imagine you have a black screen, which looks like, oh, great, I have a black screen, but only like the middle third of it is actually LED. And the others, so the middle part is driven by software. The rest, there's sort of like little indicator lights that come on. So there's a mix of indicator lights and LED, and that's just right in front of the driver. That's the main display for, you know, what you look at all the time. Then there's a second display that's sort of hovering in the middle of the dashboard. And I think this is from the old tradition because you used to have a front dash and then you had this display that sort of started growing out of the
middle
console.
The passenger, middle. Sure.
And this is just – it's a kludge. It's absolutely
it
kludge.
It is a complete kludge, yes, I know.
and then the controls ended up in a knob in the middle.
Right.
But I drove a BMW in the summer when I was in Europe and I drove around in a 3 Series for a while. And I got kind of – you stop thinking that this is abnormal. But if you step into a computing world and you say, why are they doing it this way? It's like having, you know, this is what it would be. You're typing along on your keyboard and then there's an LED monitor stuck to the keyboard. And then there's another monitor that you look up, you see what I mean? There's like your line of sight monitor and then your secondary monitor. Why have two monitors? It doesn't make sense, right? So so there's a lot of that stuff that goes on. And I think a lot of that is legacy. A lot of that is because of the
supply chain. They're making them. They cost 10 cents.
And yeah,
you've got the parts bin. It's all there. Exactly.
They went into the parts bin.
Yeah. And they just
absolutely.
Did it. It was a mistake. Anyway.
But there's my expectations are in a sense diminished because of living in that world and we're used to it. And I think you're right. If they had a clean sheet of paper, why did they not re-engineer, redesign?
The user experience. And I think this gets to the heart of the challenge the existing players have. You know, there's news this morning, and I can't remember the German publication, but that Apple has set up shop in Berlin. And that they have hired, and again, you know, some of this might be marketing spin, who knows, but they've hired young engineers, young German engineers who were oppressed by the existing car makers, you know, now have their opportunity. I mean, it was a great
article.
They're
in the syndicalist commune.
Right, exactly.
They were no longer oppressed.
Working for Apple in Berlin, and I think it's strategically brilliant to do it in Berlin, because of the German ecosystem. But I think that gets to the heart of my original question on brands. Because, you know, where are you going with this thing, and do they have the cojones, the intestinal fortitude to pull it off and do what needs to be done? And I have my doubts on the existing players.
Yeah, you know, as the general theme of the show goes, you know, two steps forward, two steps back.
right, and maybe three sometimes.
You never know. I think the thing is that learning from the i3, learning also, by the way, I'm still building my VW, which actually is coming along nicely. I'm at the stage now where almost all the interior is done, and at least done enough that I can move to the next project.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain symmetry to having those two projects or two cars at your fingertips. I like
that. It's fascinating. So let me give you a few more comments on the i3 because I think the i3, the sense that this is where the numbers don't talk to you. It's the, what the feeling I got driving in for more than a test drive, by the way, this is the difference. I think in the test drive, it's very hard to be thoughtful.
Well, of course, you're not living with it, and it's part of your daily life.
I ended up with the multi-day test drive, and what I got out of it. I don't know if I should thank the folks. Peabody BMW are the folks who lent me the car. They're lovely people up here in the Boston area, BMW dealership. But what I got from the longer test drive is that I didn't test acceleration. I don't care. It's nice. It's good enough. I didn't test braking or I didn't test
lateral force.
I didn't get, you know, I do not care how much the lateral G's are. I really don't. I don't care how quickly it charges, although I did charge it a couple of times. I did not do tests in the mud and the snow. I did not try to take it off road. I didn't do any of those things.
So there was no snow during your test, right?
No snow, and I didn't take it to Alaska to find out.
Quebec, maybe.
If you want product reviews, go search on Google or
there's
YouTube.
Plenty of those out there.
Plenty of those out there. It's been 2 years now in this business. What I wanted to get were, what does it mean when you have a carbon fiber vehicle? What does it mean? What does it mean? Yeah, it's lighter. So what? So what is lighter? So what does all that mean? It's 3,800 pounds, which is quite a lot.
Quite a lot for that size car.
But that's because there's a lot of stuff in the batteries there. But
right.
But it's low, and that does affect the handling the different ways. This is, again, you start to dig why. It's low, and yet the car is tall. Why? So what do? So they put the batteries low, but they didn't want that to eat into the
passenger space, right?
And you compare that to the Chevy Volt, in which they put them in the tunnel, and therefore, although they kept the car low, they created this essential barrier between the passengers, therefore there isn't an open air feel. You know, you feel like you're hunkered down. The difference here is that you have a very airy feel to the car, almost like a minivan, although maybe microvan. There's a lot of space front to back, and so there's all these elements. And also, when you open all the doors up, you're striking that you have no B pillar. You're just looking through
right,
a car.
Right, it's just space. Right.
It's just a big round
1960s
area.
Lincoln. Yes.
Exactly. But there's a very strange compromise there in a way. But the main thing, okay, so the handling and driving are all good enough. What matters, though, is that I think the single pedal driving gives you a sense of comfort in terms of the pace of going places. You know, you feel like in a car like this, and maybe this is true for all electric cars, although I didn't get that sensation at Tesla, I call it serenity. It's like from the Seinfeld episode, Serenity Now.
That's a long way from the ultimate driving machine horse.
Right. But
Serenity.
I'm the slowest guy on the road with this car and loving it. And this is what they should market it as. Be the slowest person on the road. That is the message here.
Well, that harkens back to the Volkswagen, right? I remember many times being on the Autobahn and just going past old bugs, right? And they're going at their pace. I mean, it's just hilarious.
Sure.
So the i3, absolutely, same thing.
Yep, you'd be the happiest, slowest guy in the world because you're just like, you don't care. You feel like so comfortable and serene. And you're in traffic and it doesn't feel bad. And this is another thing. I talked about this on the Critical Path. It's like, I think they kind of are taking on the job to be done of help me get through traffic better.
Right. The interior looks more like furniture. I agree.
Well, it's not that. It's not that. Because you're not stepping on the brake, you're not feeling the motor and the heat and the vibration, all that stuff. It's only like, you know, I could be doing something else. Maybe I'll enjoy my music a bit better because it's quieter.
But
maybe
it's less effort to use the single pedal, right?
I'll call people up, and then it's like somehow you feel like you're no longer stressed out by things. You feel like taking it easy. You feel like going slower. And that's an interesting concept. If an auto manufacturer convinces you that it's better to go slow, it's better to not care that you're going slow, then they've done something magical.
Yes.
And it's – It's a question of whether they have or haven't. I don't know yet. But for me, my point of view, I used to stress about leaving at the wrong time of day because I'd be in traffic. Now with this car, I'm like, I don't care. And it's not because it somehow cussets you in opulence. It's somehow that just gives you serenity. And it just, you just feel like, you know, I don't care. It's just, I don't mind being like this. And by the way, you know, I'll do something else. So it's not making up for the traffic by giving you, you know, a lounge to sit in with a cigar and a cognac or you know, well, let's not talk about alcohol now. But I'm saying something like, you know, let's be in the smoking lounge versus saying, you know, I'm gonna be in a hip bar or again a coffee shop. Sorry. I don't know. I'm struggling with the metaphor here, but there's this notion in driving it that I felt that the job here was very orthogonal, maybe even opposite to the job of BMWs being hired to do, to the point where, like here, and I don't want to pick on the guy. I mean, he was a nice guy, but you know, the guy who was setting up the car was explaining, of course, his love of the brand BMW, and he was talking. We were talking about diesel because I was telling him I have diesel minis. And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Like, you know, oh, here's your cruise control." And who would ever want to use cruise control? You know, you know, as a BMW guy, you know what I mean, right? I'm like,
oh, come on, this is 2016.
I love cruise control. I would love cruise control to the point where it does everything. In fact, this car is perfect for the self-driving idea.
Yes, it's absolutely.
Like, I wish that the seat would just swivel so I could look backwards, you know, and talk to my friends or something like that. So there's this element of taking away the driving, and yet if you want to, you could throw it around and do all kinds of stuff. I mean, acceleration really is stunning. 0 to 40, I think 0 to 60 slows down a bit, but
right. It's surprisingly sprite. I agree.
Yes, yeah. Surprisingly a good. Yeah. And I know, the range anxiety, that's another thing. Who cares? The car's got can go 100 miles with, if you really take it easy, if you're like in Eco Pro mode or Eco Pro Plus mode, and you're just barely driving. Like if you drive at 28 miles an hour, which is the average traffic speed, you know, traffic, it'll go forever, right. You know, because you're never really burning a lot.
You're not getting there anyway.
You don't have any aerodynamic drag. Right. At that speed, right, there's no aerodynamic drag. It's all friction drag, and friction is very minimal, especially in a new car with these skinny tires. And you're going to do very well at that speed. But the point is that it's just gives you a whole different feeling of the job there. And I was pleasantly surprised, in fact, so much so that I'm sort of looking at buying one.
So which leads to the next question. And I think I posted this on a SimCar a while ago that, you know, maybe last fall or last summer, I saw some of these things at a dealer with balloons on them with big stickers on showing the lease deal and the discount and all that stuff. And so is this a car that one should own, or just given the inevitability of a BMW transforming certain parts into gold, you know, should we lease the thing if you're interested, if you want to be part of this, you know, or you can buy one used for $25,000 with 1,400 miles on it, but do you want to own one? Version one.
This is not a program where you're going to give you a consumer advice, because I feel it's all, you know, it's like you can be informed about leases and you can be informed about loans and other forms of ownership or not ownership, economics discussion, all you want elsewhere. But what I think, you know, so circumstances are going to dictate all of that information. It's not going to be that this is right for you. This is more like, is this right for you today, given the people you've talked to in the last 30 minutes? Or is this right for you, given the circumstances of the next period of time when you'll be in a decision? This goes way deep into the jobs to be done thing. I think we also picked up on this job to be done about so if I were to compare this car to a Porsche, you know, or my Porsche, for example, it's like, they're not even the same universe. It's not about performance. They're not in the same universe as jobs are concerned. I can't I think there's no room for me to add value here in this discussion about what the right way of owning this car or not
or
owning
consuming
this car.
It right or using it.
I think that this is the innovations that the distributor of the car needs to work on, is to figure out different ways of owning it and different ways of fitting or conforming to your needs at the moment of sale. I will say one thing which we forgot to go back to is that it is sold through the same dealers. They did not create a new dealer network, whereas they do separate the mini brand, which is fascinating. Even though they're usually in the same neighborhood or in the same, even adjacent, they call the BMW a BMW store. And I was like struck by the fact that I was in the BMW dealership. I said, "You guys sell minis here?" He said, "The mini store is right next to us."
Right.
And I don't know. And later on in the test drive, I said, "Oh yeah," because we ran into the parking lot and drove around the parking lot for a while, and there was a bunch of minis in the parking lot. "Oh, I see all these new minis." I'm looking and I'm asking the BMW guy, "So, there's a lot of minis out here. Are you guys selling them well? Are you selling well?" "I don't know anything about the mini sales rate." So it was like it was shocking how separate the two. I would bet.
Yeah, whether that'll survive, who knows.
No, but I would bet that this was owned by the same person, right?
It's likely, absolutely. Yeah.
And yet, they really drew a line and said, "These are
a different deal, different experience." Yeah.
But he didn't do that with the eye. Maybe the volumes aren't there, right? Mm-hmm. They probably know the volumes aren't there. The volume of minis being produced is on the order of 300,000.
Half a million, 400,000. Yeah.
No, not yet. Four. I think 350 is probably the limit. Right.
Maybe
now.
The SUV will push it over, Horace. Yes.
Are they coming up with an SUV?
Of course.
Well, in that case, it'll probably double.
Yes, exactly.
But the shocking thing again with the X model is that this idea of making an electric SUV just makes my brain.
Exactly. Well, but that's the gist of the question. So, and the interesting thing about the way that that if you watch this brand exercise, both directly with the I brand, but then these sort of service brands, transport as a service, car as a service, parking, all these things, that. This is an interesting segue, I think, into where Apple and others might enter, because if in fact the product is an app and cars are scattered around town, I think in Seattle maybe they had 500, I think Berlin 700, something. I don't know the exact numbers, but so they're available and they're parked in different places, and you can just go and you've got your credentials and you take it and you go. So you're not really buying it, but you're experiencing it, and maybe this is the beginning of that for BMW. They wanted to get a few out there.
Yeah,
it's just
the volumes there. I mean, you're not going to keep a line busy with that kind of services, not yet. And so the problem is, again, we're in the period of transition. Even this model, it's built using a carbon process. It's built using mostly robotics, except for the final assembly. And even there, that's a fairly light a light amount of work needed to do the final assembly. There are videos on YouTube I recommend to watch how
right,
the car is
along
built.
With the teardown too. So along those lines of business model, though, I was catching up a little bit last night in my reading, and there was an interview with Ford CEO Mark Fields in Barron's this weekend, and he said this. So this gets to my point. We have had a company based on unit sales. We're looking at having a business model based on vehicle miles traveled. That opens up your mind. Now, the first thing that comes to mind is if the game changes to that, I have a hard time believing that the current supply chain will survive, because I think the numbers change dramatically. But I could be wrong. But and Ford is, he said in this article, they've had, I think, 30 experiments around the world in card swapping, ride sharing, and other services related to these mobility changes. So that if you're thinking about the job to be done as distance traveled, this morning, this afternoon,
yeah,
this
but
evening,
we
whatever.
Just know this is such a tiny part of the jobs that cars are hired to do.
Yes.
And this is the trouble, is that they're collecting data and then they're trying to draw conclusions. What's the point of a study? You do a study in order to collect data. Collect data on what? what people think about doing this. Fine, but you're not going to get the subtle data that you're going to get from an interview that, that says, no, but really, what would you do?
And I feel better in traffic, as you said, right?
It's like Bob Messer did a gave a great talk where he talked about a family buying a car, and they said, you know, they came to him and they said, look, we're trying to decide on a car, and we've got these criteria. There's only one other. There's only one negative criteria. So we wanted to do this, this, and that, but it cannot be a minivan. That was the way they wanted to buy a car. And then 3 months later, he interviews them about, you know, their outcome and
what
and,
happened. Yeah,
yeah, and what happened? Of course, they bought a minivan.
Right.
People lie to themselves all the time. Right. They're biggest liars, especially to themselves. And so the fact is that if you then do a study and you observe people and then you say, okay, if your observation is on miles driven and, you know, money spent, and things you can measure, that's what a study does. It measures things. And what does it measure? Things you can measure. What does it not measure? Things you cannot measure. Obviously, you're going to measure things you cannot measure. You cannot measure things you cannot measure. So the problem is that when it comes time to buy a car and or to make a decision about allocating your personal resources, decisions are not made on things which typically can be measured in a study. That's the problem. And so I'd be very careful about drawing conclusions from...
Well, it gets better. So I'll give you the my favorite line of the article. So then he said, it used to be that the future belonged to the company that made the best products. And then he goes on, and I think this is where maybe everybody's learning too much from Google and Facebook. Today, the future goes to the company that makes the best products and collects the best data to turn into services. This is the Ford CEO, Mark Fields.
Well, collecting data and then trying to be in the data business, that's another thing. I mean, it's not so easy. You always think that, oh, we'll just become a data company. If you think about who has a lot of data, which could be, they could sell it tomorrow. Who has a lot of data? Turns out the insurance companies have a lot of data. Why don't they become a data-driven business?
Their business is data driven.
Well, it's to themselves.
Right?
Why don't they just collect it and ship it?
Right.
But the other thing is, who had a before the internet came along? It was the phone companies had a lot of data.
Sure.
So the companies which sat on a lot of information about customer behavior were phone companies, and phone companies knew who you talked to, how long you talked,
and how frequently,
how far you talked, how far
sure, the
you
distance.
Called,
yep.
And then you probably do a lot more if you had some.
Did you pay on time? How frequently you pay?
Yeah, exactly.
How did you pay? Where did it come from?
You have economic data. You have behavior data. You have all kinds of data. And they didn't go and become a search company. In fact, I worked on search in between 1987 and 1993. I had almost 5 years. Actually, not the whole time. It was 6 years, but not all the time I was on this project. But I was on search in those years. And who employed me was a phone company. And the phone company was looking to search as a tool to be used in conjunction with, for example, it's another thing it had was Yellow Pages. Here's Yellow Pages information, right? Imagine if you could collect the data from people using the Yellow Pages. If you had an electronic Yellow Pages back before the internet, what would you know? You would know not just what people talk to, but you would find out their interaction with the Yellow Pages, and then you would be able to sell that data to businesses. All of that was possible in decades before the internet came along. But they didn't. Why didn't they? And that's the point. They didn't because they had a business model that was predicated on selling minutes of talk time. And so the idea of selling data or metadata on those minutes was part of it was also regulatory issues, but fundamentally there was an obstacle, mental obstacle in transitioning to this logic. And so it's now, if a car company today were to step in and say, well, fine, we get it now, it's all about data, still to become having your resources, processes, and priorities around this new thing, it's not just, you know, again, we were funded by a research project that the company itself thought was useful enough to sort of fund people to look at search and dream up new opportunities, but none of these made it out of the labs. And so nowadays, in sort of if you imagine a business model laboratory, you know, none of these ideas really
Department
make it
of Innovation,
far.
Horace. Yes.
But you see, I don't know if I'm making my point well, but my point is how I'm trying to say how it's one thing to say, it's one thing to run around, it's one thing to build brands, it's one thing, and yet another thing to actually execute. It's another thing altogether to be successful doing these things.
Right, going from 100 years of assembly line and financing and supply chain and, you know, traditional brands to transport as a service and apps and data mining, all these other things, it's going to be difficult. And the other little piece of data I saw recently that I thought was interesting was...
Oh, we should get back to this Apple thing, by the way, the news that broke today, which was that Apple's hiring engineers in Germany.
Oh,
but
in
also,
Berlin, yeah, of course.
Yeah, but also...
Oh, the contract manufacturer, Magna.
The same piece, there was... Yeah. That was the thing. So here's one way to think about it. I just thought about it today. Now, I wrote this piece, I don't know how long ago, a year ago at least, and it was called The Ten Commandments, or something along the lines of how the industry operates. And so what were these commandments? You know, making many things is much harder than making a few very, very fancy things. It's hard to make a car go far. It's easy to make it go fast. There's no such thing as contract manufacturing was one of these, right? And so there's
in serious volume, there's small ones, yeah.
Yeah, so and even then, and many people came back to me and said, "Oh, Magnus there is doing it." I knew, of course, even before then that small outfit in
Finland,
Finland, the Valmet Automotive is.
Right.
Jetra used to be a factory making guns. I kid you not.
I think they made tractors, too, at one point.
Made many things. It's just basically a manufacturing concern. Mm-hmm. And so my car, my Porsche, was made in Finland, actually. So they would. There are these instances. I think there's Magna is also doing work in Canada. But the point is that these are tiny numbers. And so in order to break the commandment, it's not enough to say, well, there is some. In order to break the commandment is to say there's nothing but that. I mean, because what happened in the manufacturing of electronics is exactly this transition. It used to be that if you were RCA or Zenith, you made your own televisions, you made your own radios in your own factories with your own workers.
And you had your own radio stations. You were fully
and
integrated.
Well, the way back you did that also, you know, fully own the whole chain.
Sure, the whole chain.
And you had your own service shops, you know.
Exactly. Certified service, yes.
And or they send out a repairman,
right?
You know. So the thing is that what happened in that industry is like completely broke up into a value chain, a highly granular value chain. And so what we're having now with the auto industry is some, but not complete. And there's some in terms of the parts and. In the supplier chain, but not yet in manufacturing, not yet in powertrain, and not yet in electronics. So a lot of those, or I shouldn't say electronics, but the integrated final product. But the point is that if I were to say, what does the manufacturing future look like? Is what Apple would bring is that they would say, you know, we're going to make a rule in our operating. We're not going to own the factories. And yet, we're going to make millions of these. And that means we're going to empower Magna to make millions of cars. That means we're going to make the
They're looking for a Foxconn of cars,
but,
yeah, of course.
But Foxconn was made by Apple.
Absolutely, yes.
See, that's the thing, of course.
But that guy was hungry. He was amazing. They found the right organization to make
that
happen.
Yeah, and that's maybe what's necessary here is that they need to find a partner who's going to say, yep, I'll step right up and yes, sir. You know,
I'll deal with all the dirt, all the problems.
And I'll take a cut in margins. Right. I'll be super flexible. Yep. I've never been so flexible before.
Exactly.
I'll be super lean and super hungry, and I've never done these things. I'm going to go way over because...
Yeah. You'll pay me in advance. Thank you very much. Apple's very good at that.
No. My point is that in 10, 20 years... I'll be bigger than General Motors.
Yes, exactly.
That's what they need to be pitched by Tim Cook and say, Tim, they're going to be asked for a lot of concessions. They're going to say you're going to take a cut on this. You're going to take a cut on that. You're going to
1% margins will be fine. Yes,
but we'll finance. We'll help you out. We'll tell you what. We'll finance the capital.
Working capital, everything. It's all us. Yeah. Yep.
So we'll work on the. We'll have the financial leverage, but you're going to take some of the risk. And that's what they did, by the way. That's what they did with that outfit with the Sapphire venture.
Oh, right.
So the Sapphire venture, which imploded horribly, but that's exactly the model. And there was a new process, a new technology, a new team, They raised money, got a lot of money from Apple, and then Apple ended up owning them at the end and having to dispose of the assets. But that's the
part of the game.
You had to go through bankruptcy to do it. But that's what Magna would be essentially asked to do this. Mm-hmm. Step up, prepare for bankruptcy, or if you succeed,
a rocket ship,
that's right. We'll make you bigger than GM.
That's right.
Bam, that's the bet. And so if that happens, then that means you broke a commandment. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to enable a supplier to become, in fact, generating probably, Apple gets, let's say, $100, whatever the final price is, and they pass on 80% to these guys. Mm-hmm. So they make a 20% gross margin, which would be huge, by the way, but in the auto industry, but not so big.
It's not so big in their current business. Yeah.
But from a sales level, Magna would become,
enormous.
Literally enormous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, what Magna would do is then they would turn around and say, hey, we're killing it with Apple. How would you like to,
Samsung, here we go.
Mr. General Motors, how would you like to do your business with us? Hey, you don't have
get rid of those plants. Yeah.
To keep these things on your books.
Right.
And bam, one after the other, the dominoes fall, and suddenly the industry pivots. And that is exciting. That really changes the game. So will they do it? We don't know. But the idea of Magna working with Apple is not surprising. Apparently, BMW did not step into a deal. Probably they tried. I don't know. Who knows? And maybe that's one of the issues that, as an incumbent, you find this extremely difficult to do a deal on. And stay tuned.
So I think that maybe reveals a little bit of the puzzle. But we've talked about all sorts of other pieces that are yet to be exposed. And that specifically is the retail model, how this thing ends up at your home. Or as a service, or how that all plays out, and that seems quite murky. And maybe they'll just use the current store, and it'll all be a virtual experience. And who knows? Buy it online, or buy it with your app. But it's always great to catch up, Horace, and a good chat on the i3 today.
i3, yeah. So. I am a fan, but by the way, it's a reversal of an opinion that I had earlier, but I hadn't really looked at it very closely, and now I had a chance to. And I have to say, it's a pretty clever car. And the problem is, here's my concern, is that cars I like tend not to be very well liked by others. I think I'm notorious because I end up buying cars that are significant.
You're the Grim Reaper, Horace.
A lot of cars I like are what many people, I'm not the one saying this, but many people are eventually come around to calling significant. But by the way, that makes them often collectible. So the flip side of this is that if you in order to be collectible and make money with collecting cars, you have to find a gem in the rough. You have to find a car that is actually great, but nobody cares at the time mm-hmm. when it's being made.
Yeah.
And so very few are made, very few are preserved, very few survive. And as a result, by the time it matures to being old and rare and good, then it becomes a classic. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to have many cars which were wildly popular be classic.
Exactly.
And so I can guarantee you no SUV in the history of the world will ever be a classic. Ever. Just write
write it down, put it in stone.
The very first one, which was the Range Rover, but even that has a lot of asterisks after it, right? Because it falls apart, it's no good, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then
yeah, early
and
yes, Land Cruiser.
But it's a classic
because it was the very
first one.
Yes.
And that was that, but ever since, nothing.
All right, great, Horace. Thanks.
All right.